If everyone has a handout,
we're going to start serving up portions of this hot dish right away. 2 days ago, I looked at we're talking about music in the midst of life. What role music plays in each of our lives? And I, in exploring this, it's an exploration, it's not an answer. I looked at, on Monday, at the life of a particular composer, Johann Sebastian Bach, and Tuesday, Chris looked at the life of a couple other particular composers, a few others, and we tried to get into their mindset and into their milieu to feel more closely what they were doing and what their music still does for us. Today we're going to explore in a little more generalized terms. It'll be to use one analogy, sort of like the fact that it's wonderful to observe Railroad Creek from a distance and hear it babbling, but when you get up close to it and peer down into its clearness and see the multiplicity of rock shapes, and you see the shimmer of a fish behind a boulder, and you turn over a rock and you see the nymph of a mayfly, and you realize all these individual ingredients that make up the beauty of the stream, and how starting to see the particulars helps us see and feel the whole. Another analogy that I've used here, it's like the delicious hot dish your mother served you or your father, and you take a big bite and it's just the savory wholeness of it gives you comfort, but then you pull out a carrot and you nibble out it and say, this individual carrot is my favorite part of it. Oh, it's sort of flavored by rosemary and parsley maybe, and it's just a hint of hotness to it, and I like the texture a lot, and yeah, that's it. You get into that carrot. We're going to try to do that with music. So wish us luck. The one thing is that we're working with a very natural set of ingredients. Up on the at our cabin in Minnesota the other day, just recently, I heard this. If I can do it without smiling. Over and over again, same pitches, same rhythmic pattern. So I explored and find out that I'm pretty sure it's this white-throated sparrow, which also sings, and it sounds sort of like the beginning of, and so they call it the O Canada song. But in our neck of the woods, it was lovely, very pure, very scalar, very rhythmic. What that bird is working with is a flute.
In fact, it carries a little baroque in it.
You hear different birds, they have different mechanisms. Crow, definitely a vibrating membrane, very raucous vibrating membrane. Other birds, nuthatches, like make little noises and things like that. I can't do it very well, and woo-hoo-hoo-hoo gives this big whistly sound. But this is a high flute, and it's working with the natural system of overtones that you find in every sound in nature. And it's doing it as a flute does it. A flute works not with a vibrating membrane or reed or lips or anything like that. It works with a simple airstream. And a simple airstream, this sparrow knows, has a certain coherence. When you blow a stream of air, it's like a current of water or a droplet. It likes to stick together. It has a stick-togetherness to it. But when it hits the edge, which is probably the beak in this case, it gets confused. The stream of air hits an edge and it wants to stick together, but the edge gets in the way, so it doesn't know whether it should stick together up or stick together down. And so it gets a serious case of indecision, and it goes up, down, up, down, up, down, and does that extremely rapidly, but it's pulling the whole airstream behind it like a rope, which has a lot of mass to it. So the speed at which it can go up and down is how fast it can move that whole airstream up and down. The sparrow has a very small rope of wind behind it, so there's not much mass to pull, so it can go very rapidly, it can make a very high pitch as a result, because pitch is the frequency of oscillation of an airstream. But it's making three different pitches, so that's one interesting thing. And it's a simple sine wave, the simplest of waves, very clear, very unpolluted by timbre, just very clear. But it's making three different pitches. Why is it making three different pitches? Because it's running out of air. As the higher pitch, it's getting a little more air force, so it's hitting a higher overtone in a series of overtones, and then it's going down very high up in the overtone series. We're going to visit that overtone series and see some really interesting things about it, and I hope that it doesn't become too confusing. It's really so beautifully simple that it's going to be fun, and we'll see eventually how this comes into play in what we hear in church, in the symphony hall, in the blues, etc. We've been hearing this. Do I have on the piano here? Someplace? Okay, on this one. What does it say to you as a whole theme?
Energy.
Energy. There's a ton of energy there. Anything else?
Magnificent.
Which?
Magnificent.
Magnificent. It's brilliant in its magnificence.
Triumph.
Triumph. You start out with 1-5, 1-5 in the kettle drum. Bum, 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 bum. Is called hunting fifths from two hunting horns. And horns, the original hunting horns and the Baroque horns, predecessors of the French horn, had no valves. And so as you change your embouchure and your wind pressure, you go up and down the overtone series. And if you have two horns, they're popping up and down the overtone series together, and at a certain point, they make these thirds and sixths and fifths. And so it's the sound of two horns, and so we call those the hunting fifths. So this is a very rustic and joyous chase, as you will. And that's a typical chase theme in classical music, the chasse, the chase, the hunting chase. But now, the second time it does it, and I've reharmonized it a little bit because I think they could have done the Olympic thing. The second time through, they don't go boom, boom. They actually start harmonizing it in a different way. And they go down the scale like this in the bass. I think it would have been nicer if they went. Now, this chord, say something about that chord.
Oh, no.
Oh, wow.
Did I do that?
No,
sure it's electricity. Yeah, it'll come back on.
Okay, very good.
It was so powerful.
I know.
Yeah.
Okay.
It didn't affect the piano.
It didn't affect
it's
the piano.
It's not an electrifying
chord. Thank goodness
chord.
For acoustic instruments. So it is a bright chord, and we're going to visit why it's bright a little later on. And then if I went to that second harmonization, what does that second chord say to you? What does it introduce into the melody? What does it introduce? What kind of feeling? Is it a different, is it the same feeling or a different feeling?
It's a movement, it's an uplift.
If there's an uplift to it,
softer.
It's a little softer, it's a softer chord, it's a minor chord in that scale. Another?
Celebration.
There's a little celebratory, but there's sort of a...
I hear some melancholy.
There's a little subdued nature in that melancholy.
It's like a little more silver, a little more instead of the gold.
It's silver instead of gold, or even bronze maybe. Okay. So, we have this very simple melody that we've heard a million times, but when you start taking it apart, you realize that different parts of it are having different immediate, instantaneous affects on you. Now, why is that? Let's right away break out and look at the nature of sound. First of all, just a sound out of a piece of music. Let's start naming what the ingredients are as they come to mind. For example, you have three notes. What else do you have in that?
Rhythm.
You have that dotted dup ba dup ba dup ba dup ba dup. How in the Dickens did a chickadee figure out a dotted rhythm? It must be a natural phenomenon if the little chickadee is doing it. At the beginning of Messiah, you have that same dotted rhythm. Dum, da-dum, ba-da-dum. You have that same dotted rhythm that the chickadee was doing, that Handel uses to start out the symphony.
Now we know where he got it.
You know, you got it from the chickadee.
He's been in northern Minnesota.
He's been up in northern Minnesota. Who knew?
That was country.
What else? What else is part of that tone? A single tone. What would you put a single tone together of? Just give me the ingredients of a single tone.
Volume.
How hard it hits you.
Whether it's sustained or short.
The length of it, right? And in that, guys, whether it's sustained or short, the beginning and the end of it, is it ta-ta, or is it da-da, or is it la-la, or is it la? Does it have a sharp beginning? A crescendo beginning? Does it have a at the beginning, which is not a pitch at all, but ta ta, but what we would call an articulation, as an articulation of language. What else?
Also the release.
The release at the end, is it a decayed release? Is it a decrescendo, or is it a crisp release? What about the nature of the sound once you're sustaining it? Is it a clarinet or a trumpet or a piano or a what would we, how do we talk about that?
The
timbre of it. What's the nature of that sound? When we get into timbre, why is a flute different than a clarinet than a violin? We're talking all about the overtone series. Let's stop right there. Of course, we have all the rhythm and all the combinations, but the timbre is how a tone is constructed from the natural series of things that we call the overtone series or the harmonics of a tone. So any one pitch you hear, unless it's a pure, unadulterated sine wave that follows a regular curve up like that, is a very complex tone. All of our voices are very complex tones built up of a fundamental, the lowest pitch in it, plus a whole series of pitches above it. Mathematically speaking, it really is very simple because it's simply whole number multiples of the bottom vibration. So if you had, say, a perfect, what we would call a sawtooth wave, which is similar to a violin, you have if we call the pitch that the violin is playing one vibration per unit of time, okay, this is a unit of time, and it's going back and forth, it's pushing the air back and forth one time. That's its fundamental. It also has, in that very beating of the string isn't just going like a jump rope with one loop. It's being divided into two parts, into three parts, into four parts, into five parts, into six parts, and on almost to infinity, where the inner parts of the string are vibrating in smaller segments. Seems physically impossible, but that's actually what happens. And so you have a vibration that's twice as fast, three times as fast, four times as fast, five times as fast, and so forth. And the one that's beating twice as fast is half as loud. The one that's vibrating three times as fast is one-third as loud. Four times as fast, one-fourth as loud. So it's this beautiful, simple mathematical construct that makes up a very simple violin sound. Now, really, truly gorgeous violin tones are much more complex than that, but that's the basic sawtooth wave that a bowed string will make. Now, are people familiar with this overtone thing called the overtone series at all? Jay is back there, he's a musician. Anyone else? You are familiar with it? So for you, this will be a little bit of review, but for others, it will be hopefully an aha moment. So if we call this low C one vibration per unit of time, actually it's maybe about 100 vibrations per unit of time, but we'll call it one vibration, it's about 100 vibrations per second. But if I went up in octaves, it would be 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. There's a discrepancy there. That discrepancy of about 1% is called the Pythagorean comma. And it was discovered about 5th century BC by Pythagoras. it's amazing how he could have figured that out.
He didn't have a calculator.
Now, we've talked about this fifth. The falling fifth, let's say from G down to C, gives a natural sense of resolution. Just like, we know in that tone that this is home base. And every time you go to the D, which is a fourth below or a fifth above, you're going away from home base and it falls back down. So if you had a major chord above, built on the fifth and resolved it to a major chord based on the fundamental, there's a sense of resolution. Part of that is synthetic, trained in by our culture and by centuries of listening to that happening, but part of it is very natural. Let's take the 12-bar blues.
Yes.
The 12-bar blues, what's amazing, what amazes me about the 12-bar blues, as we heard Robert Johnson sing, is that it's harmonically so simple. You have three harmonies. You have those two harmonies I just played, plus you have one more added. So it starts out. Goes up to the four chord, which is in this, I'm in G major, so it does that for a couple measures. And then for one measure you get that D major chord, but it doesn't resolve it in a traditional schooled Western harmony way. It slides down to the four chord and then resolves. Tell me what this does for you. Anybody?
Yeah, feels done.
Feels done. Okay. What does this do for you? Also feels done.
Yeah.
Amen. The great Amen cadence. It's called a plagal cadence. Plagal cadence, also a Greek name, because it goes back so far to an area of Greece. But it has this sense of softly falling. It's actually coming from below, up a fifth. So it's like it's reaching up to the fundamental and putting it there. So you have this sense in blues, and it then went into pop music, rock and roll. That's a very much a rock and roll progression and a blues progression. Now, the interesting thing is that the blues can be so honest and truth-telling and wrenching, but it's that it's in a major triumphant key. Now, I think that's because in the blues, the difference between major and minor isn't that great, because you have the blue note. The blue note is the third. But is it major third? Or is it minor third? Or is it both? It's so mutable. So you have this. Woke up this morning. So you have a blue note against the major third, where it's somewhere around, and so you have this extreme dissonance set up. So within a major system, you have a tension that comes into it, and it's out of this tension of the blues note and this simple, honest progression that forms sort of the framework, and this grew up naturally in a culture. I had to do another analysis here, if we can see this at all. Let's see if it works. Please forgive me for this. Does it work? Come on. I bet I have to go to, oh, I have to do. Okay, here we go.
There.
Let's see if I can go back and get it with. Okay, let's try it this way. Here we go. Can you get a cherry in at that point?
It's a small world after all. Don't know anything but that. I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts.
Okay.
There they are, standing in.
Escape. Okay, find it is. So, anyway. Why is It's a Small World Anyway so memorable, and why can't we get it out of our head? We will have a chance to erase it later on, but right now, it starts out with the major triad with the octaves on the outside. You can't get more simple than that. And then it goes up a step to the dominant, back to tonic, and then to the fourth degree, to the fourth dominant tonic. So you have the same three chords operating, and they're operating exactly as they have to in the right order, and the scale goes 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 5, 5, 1. So it gets stuck because it's so simple. The simplest of melodies get stuck most easily. Let's get out of that quickly.
Want to put it on the big view?
Pardon?
Put it on the big view.
All right, thank you. The cosmic triad. We're going to deal with this E-flat major triad. The triad comes in so many incarnations. Here it is. Triad is the first partial of the overtone series, the third partial, and the fifth partial, crunched together into one compressed chord. So it's all in the overtone series. And if this piano were tuned justly with all three perfect intervals, it would sound even more solid than that. Now, if we have it with the root on the top and the bottom, or the fundamental on the top and the bottom, it sounds solid. You could also take that and spread it out. It sounds more heroic. You can take it and put the fifth on the top, and it sounds a little bit like one of those cairns that you see around the village that have rocks balanced on rocks. It becomes a little less stable. And you can put it with the third on the top. The third is a rather bright note, so it makes it a rather bright note. If you put it with the third on the bottom, it's so unstable that it has to go someplace. Stay there, and especially if you put the fifth on the bottom, as you have at the end of the first line, I think, let me read my writing, it's got to resolve because it becomes dissonant. And there it becomes stable or consonant. Now, if we change the in the overtone series, we have you have your third there, but then the next third is what we have dubbed the minor third. And it doesn't relate, it relates from the fifth to the sixth member of the overtone series, and so it's not the root interval. So it's a sort of a darker interval. Now if we take that interval and put it on top, get a minor chord. It's very interesting that the blues progression doesn't use the minor chord as its home base, but it uses sort of a combination of that. Now, if we take this chord and get something like this, all of a sudden becomes huge and heroic. And that's what Beethoven does in his third symphony, the Eroica symphony, which he, of course, means the heroic symphony, the Eroica means the hero, which was originally intended to be an honorific symphony for Napoleon, but then Napoleon did some very nasty things and Beethoven scratched out Napoleon's name on it and simply wrote Eroica. So he has these two big chords, and huge chords from way below the bass clef to way above it, from the double basses E-flat to the flutes up in E-flat, and so it's spread out as far as you can in the orchestra. And it's sort of like the orchestra saying, yes, yes, twice in a row. And then it softens, because the first two notes you don't know what the rhythm is until you get to the third measure. Get the triad outlined in this beautiful flow, but there's a little uneasiness to it. Because you have the agitated violins, the chung, 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 chung. And then the an ordinary mortal would have gone, would have done it again in the major key. But not Beethoven. He tried that in the sketchbook and scratched that out. He went. went down to a very dissonant interval chord. And then when it gets back to the one chord, we have a leftover note, which kind of leaves you hanging. And then he gets out of it. He sneaks back out of it. But so he comes in with these big triumphant chords, which says, yes, yes, la di da, and then soothes you, da da da, and it becomes blue. It becomes haunted. And let's hear it reading. Okay, there he's reached the five, the fifth, the dominant. And so it's balanced up there, the dominant. It's got to go someplace. I was just doing some exploration. And that's where we're going to stop, because so far we're just exploring. Okay, we reached the tonic again. We reached home, so we can go on. Skip up one century. Only one century from about a little before 1830 to about 1930, Sergei Koussevitzky asked Igor Stravinsky, by then a very famous composer, to do something for the 100th anniversary of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And Stravinsky chose to write a symphony that incorporated voices in it, not simply something for the orchestra. And it was based upon three psalms. And the three psalms, I can't remember what they were offhand, except the last one is Psalm 150. So the first psalm has to do with alienation of the individual from God. It's a lament. The second psalm is a reconciliation psalm, a rescuing psalm, and the third psalm is a jubilation psalm. So, here it starts out with E minor chords, big, huge E minor chords that did exactly what Stravinsky did, and gave you this huge exclamation point at the beginning. Now the funny thing is, Stravinsky is all about rhythm, and is all about catching you off balance. So his chords come when you least expect them. You have to be watching around, or they're going to sneak up on you. And so Sergei Koussevitzky gets up there and goes like this, and nothing happens. So you go one, two. The first chord comes on the second beat, and so there's this visual alienation that you have from the harmony. It's a darker harmony, and it comes when you're not expecting it, and the audience probably went like that and jumped up in their seat a little bit. It's an argument for live music. It doesn't quite happen the same way on CD. So let's listen to that. And then he does it. He's not satisfied with just two repetitions of this chord. He's going to do it about four times before the voices come in, and then he's going to play with it with Stravinskian type of scales. Saudi, hear me. there's that big chord again. Boom. So this chord, does it do something different for you than the beginning of the Eroica to it? Does it have a different feel to it? Of course it does. How does it feel different to you?
Feels a little out of sync.
A little out of sync.
Uneasy.
It's very short. Mm-hmm. The E flat chord at the beginning of the Eroica is a full quarter note, so it's not staccato. It's just full. This one is bing, just a spear out of the dark. And bum, bum, bum. The fifth is in the top rather than the root in the top, so it gives an unbalanced feeling harmonically. And it keeps coming back at different intervals. Hmm. And then when the voice comes in, what do the voices do? Well, first of all, they're saying, hear me, O Lord, in my distress. And what kind of interval do you hear? Exaudi. What's the nature of that interval? In any terms.
It's like a half step. Is that what you mean?
It's a half step. It's very, 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 it's the smallest possible step.
Yeah.
It just pushes you up, and it becomes like a sigh. Through the history of music, the half step has been the sigh motif.
Yeah.
It's the motif that composers use when they signify desperation or sadness or loss. And so we start out with these big and mysterious chords, and then the chorus sing this sigh motif on the lament. Hear me, O Lord.
Is there like a book now that musicians can study that says saying things with music? And like, if you want to sigh, do this. I mean, how do people know that?
I think for one thing, it's a long tradition, but I don't think there's a concise book. No.
Well, that's what I was wondering, if like the tradition had developed enough that it was codified into
But going backwards, there were many people in the 16th through 18th century that wrote about the theory of the doctrine of affects. Mm-hmm. And the doctrine of affects
that
that each key, C major, A major, A minor, B flat major, had its own mood to it and was used for different types of music. So there was sort of an accepted thing that D major, if you wanted to write something that was for military triumph or for great jubilation, it was D major. If you want to write in a funereal key, it's C minor. Funeral marches are typically C minor, and so there's a sense of association of key with mood. That changed in the 19th century because we went to equal temperament to the modern piano, and all the keys started to sound a little bit more the same. But it's still in the back of composers' minds that if you write an E-flat major, you have this richness, not the brilliance of D major, but the deep richness of E-flat major that gives you just this wonderful sense of ebullience. Whereas C minor, quite the same signature, but down the third, gives you a feeling of extreme darkness and sadness. So it still is operating to a bit. And you had in 18th century dance and opera, you had a whole written down system of hand symbols, so that when you were singing and you said God, you always went like that. And when you sang about your heart or love, you always went like that. And so singers would always use hand gestures very formally when they were singing French Baroque music, for example.
So if you went through Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier and heard all of those different keys, you could get the mood of each one of these?
Yes, especially if you were on a harpsichord that used Bach's tuning to it. Yeah, and that was part of the Bach's demonstration, that for the first time, we could compose successfully in 12 major and 12 minor keys, because we finally, out of the thousands of different tuning systems, some people had developed a tuning system where it worked as well in A flat major as in C major, and so you have the ability, but still each one has a mood to it. And the, when he writes the prelude in C major, it's very innocent. And that's the affect of C major, innocence and sweetness. Whereas when you get the prelude in B flat minor, you get a lot of angst and darkness. And that's the affect of B flat minor. It's a tortured key. Mm-hmm. And Bach wrote for it as if it were a tortured key with great dissonances mm-hmm. in it. So yes, that's precisely what he was after in WTC. Let's skip, here's another interesting one. We have to do this briefly because the devotions this morning was Mary's song. And so, the Matins. And so, here, J.S. Bach starts with three big chords, decorated like Stravinsky did, but three different chords. And that's as much as I'm going to play, sorry. And he comes back to the home base. So he starts out, this is going to be one step higher, because they're playing in a Baroque pitch, half step lower. So he starts out with, in the D major, jubilation key. Okay, so there's the affect of keys. And then he goes down to B minor, which is the relative minor of that, and you're starting to meditate about it, because you're getting away from D major. And so it's darkened. But then he comes back to D major, but he comes back to it with a third in the bass. And so you get some unsteadiness, some openness about it. And then he goes, and he's back home very quickly. And so you get this quick process of going from bright jubilation, little darkness, unsteadiness, dominant, back home again. So it takes you through a quick 3-second trip, and you're set to say Magnificat, because you've gone through a range of motions in 5 seconds. And then you spend the next 45 minutes going through them many times in many ways. Let's do a couple of hymns. One of the ways of looking into the river of music is every time you go to church and sing a hymn, looking into the hot dish of that and savoring what the hymn writer and text writer, if they're different, are doing. What are they reaching for in that hymn? And why do they use the particular chords that they used, and why did they make it in the meter, in the tempo that it was? So let's look at one that we don't get a chance to sing too often. Let's take a chance at singing, a stab singing. Oh, love, how deep, how broad, how high. First of all, I'm going to play it, and then give us a chance to sing it. To it. What is it? What does its affect do to you? Affect that can't always be put in words, but it's what affect is what it does to you emotionally, intellectually, and what it does to you physically. Your affect, your mood. What kind of affect, what kind of feeling does this hymn have?
Marching orders.
Marching orders. It's a military hymn. It's very much, and it's called, and here it's called Deo Gracias, which God be thanked. But originally it was called the Agincourt Hymn, and it was after the great victory in England at Agincourt, long about the, I think, somewhere in the 14th, 15th century. And so this hymn was done to celebrate it, and it's been used in many different guises. And here it's used to express the profundity of God's love. Quite a stretch from a military victory to the profundity of God's love. It's sort of a turned upside down from Out of the Depths I Cry to You. This is, Oh Love, How Deep. So this is looking up at great love rather than looking up from a pit. Let's do it in unison. Ready? Sing. Is it happy or sad?
Happy.
It's happy, which goes to show you that major doesn't always mean happy and minor doesn't always mean sad. Yeah. It can be that way, but not always. Sometimes minor is very tender, sometimes it's very majestic, sometimes it's very powerful. It itself has many different aspects to it. Let's look at O Sacred Head Now Wounded. Sebastian Bach, who left us 440 chorale settings, didn't compose, to my knowledge, one chorale melody. He always set old melodies. So this is a very old 16th century melody. I believe it's one of the groups. I can't remember for sure. No, it's Hans Leo Hassler's melody. So a predecessor of Bach. And But Bach took it and made every part of it gorgeous and moving. You could almost sing each part as a melody by itself. The other thing he did to it was made dissonance in the workings of it much more strategic. So far we have just no center filling. And then you have this stretched out harmony with the third in the bass that makes you stretch. And then the bass soars up. And you have this dissonance here that has to resolve down. So right away he's having a creating a pull and a tug that pulls and tugs on your heartstrings. And the more you sing it, the deeper it gets into you. It's 12 o'clock, and we will end right there. So carry O Sacred Head Thou Wounded with you, and thank you very much for helping us look into the hot dish. And I'm sorry that if the Overtone series was too Byzantine.